and that series now tied 1-1. Today's forecast from the National Weather Service, beautiful day, sunny, breezy, and warm, a high of 77. Now 64 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, an amazing true story of courage and perseverance during the Second World War. In the second part of our program today, a look back at one of history's most important and misunderstood figures, Napoleon. The first interview airing today is actually from the Morning Show archives. It dates back to 2005. With the 60th anniversary of the ending of the Second World War, all kinds of authors and historians are taking a look back at this enormous conflict. And it is amazing how many largely untold stories are emerging from something which already has received so very much attention. And I recently have found quite interesting a brand new book called Given Up for Dead, American GIs in the Nazi Concentration Camp at Berga. This is a story which, while not entirely unknown, has been a rather obscure one. But it tells us a lot about the waning days of the European Second World War and of how troops on either side still faced great, great peril, and in fact, some ways even escalating peril, as events moved rapidly towards the conclusion of this war. The author of this book is Flint Whitlock, a veteran of the United States Army and a military historian since 1986, the author of several other books, a regular contributor to World War II magazine, and actually a Pulitzer Prize nominee. This book, once again, is called Given Up for Dead, American GIs in the Nazi Concentration Camp at Berga. And Flint Whitlock, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. That is quite a striking name you have. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Whitlock is the family name, and Flint is a nickname that I received in college when I was at the University of Illinois from my fraternity brothers, and it goes well with the last name, and I guess every author should have a name that's somewhat unusual, and so I decided to keep that and go from there.
Very good. I want to ask you also, before we begin digging into this particular book and this amazing story, as a military historian and as someone who is himself a United States veteran, how do you approach this matter of talking about military conflict? And I guess I'm asking this on behalf of anyone who might wonder if someone like yourself comes to this very much as sort of an insider, if you know what I mean, which obviously equips you to talk about this very, very well. Mm-hmm. But in terms of being fully frank and honest, for instance, about maybe mistakes made by the military, that sort of thing. Sure. Is that at all a difficult or awkward matter for you?
No, not really. One of the things that I do is I enjoy talking and interviewing veterans, talking with and interviewing them, that it's kind of like getting it straight from the horse's mouth. And a lot of times I hear, especially families of veterans, wives, sons, and daughters saying, well, gee, he never talked about his wartime experiences with me. And in many cases when I've interviewed veterans for my previous books and for this one, I've had veterans say, well, I've never told this story to my family, but I'm going to tell you, because you're a veteran, you'll understand. And I think there's a great deal of truth in that, because there's a camaraderie of people who have served in the military that it's almost like, you know, everybody has had a shared experience of one type or another. You know, a guy who was a pilot could probably talk to a sailor, and they'd both be speaking a common language, even though their experiences were vastly different. And I found that veterans are more likely to open up to me when they know that I, too, am a veteran, even though I didn't serve in World War II. I was just a small child at that time. There's a sense that, we can trust this guy. We can open up to him. He won't be judgmental, and he'll understand what we went through, and very much I appreciate that on their part. I feel sorry for their families who didn't, become the recipients of their stories, but at least through me, the families will know what their loved ones went through.
We're speaking with Flint Whitlock. The book at hand is called Given Up for Dead, American GIs in the Nazi Concentration Camp at Berga. We are talking about something which occurs very late in the Second World War, when Germany, very much on the ropes at this point, defeat all but completely inevitable, lashes out in a very unexpected offensive, and they are able to take thousands of Americans prisoner. And so your story is about that surprise attack and the capture of these Americans and the terrible ordeal which they confront then. This is not a well-known story. Is there any particular reason why this story is not better known than it is?
Well, there's probably several reasons, but maybe the most important one, and the one that's least understood, is the fact that the soldiers, after they were liberated from their captors, many of them were required to sign a secrecy agreement, I guess you could call it. The Army had said, you're not going to be discharged, you're not going to be able to go back to civilian life unless you sign this paper, and most of them, being eager to get home and see their families again, they would have probably signed their life away. But basically the document that they signed said that they were not allowed to talk about their experiences as a POW. Ostensibly, I've got a copy of the certificate that they signed in the book, and ostensibly it says that the experiences of being a POW are to remain secret so that our other enemy at that time, Japan, the war with Japan was still going on, and any other future wars where Americans might be taken prisoner must be safeguarded for the good of national security and all prisoners of war. So, you know, that sounded good, but it maybe isn't the whole truth. What I learned while doing research on the book from the National Historian of the American Ex-Prisoners of War Organization was that there was probably a document or an agreement that was made between the Americans, the British, and the Russians at the Yalta Conference of February 1945, the infamous Yalta Conference, where the U.S. basically allowed the Soviets to take over all of Eastern Europe, that had to do with the repatriation of prisoners. And this historian that I talked to has not seen the document, but in her research, she feels that, that such a document exists and was the basis for this paper that the POWs had to sign saying they would never talk about their POW experiences. Mm. And if that ever comes to light, I mean, that's going to be quite a blockbuster.
Yes. There are two ingredients in terms of the immediate events which set all of this in motion. One is the desperation of the German army to make sort of a last-ditch attack on the Allies at a point in time when, as we've already alluded to, it was all but certain that they were going down to ultimate defeat. You mentioned in your book that, that such an attack apparently had as its ultimate goal that if some damage could be done to the Allies at that late point in the war, it might pressure them into accommodating the Germans when it would come time for them to ultimately surrender.
Mm-hmm. The Germans, no matter how delusional Hitler was at that point at the end of the war, I think he always had this hope that the Americans and the British would see the light and realize that their common enemy was not Nazi Germany, but it was Bolshevik Russia and the Soviet Union. And his hope at the end, from what we know by putting together pieces of history, was that he hoped that he would inflict serious enough casualties on the Americans and British on the Western Front that they would sue for peace and join Germany in fighting the Russians and keeping the Russians out of Germany. And so that was his motivation behind this massive strike, which became known as the Battle of the Bulge in December of 44, in which thousands of Americans were taken prisoner, and from which the story of survival that ends up in Berga rests.
This is also a story of in some respects, ill-preparedness on the part of the Americans, and especially with this crucial 106th Division. You say, through no fault of its own, the 106th was about as ill-prepared for combat as any division America ever put into the field. And, of course, so it's just tremendously bad luck for them to be put in the field just at this moment, when the Germans are about to engage in this huge strike. Help us understand the ways, the most important ways, in which the 106th was so ill-prepared for this military moment.
All right. Well, the 106th was a unit that was formed late in the war and went overseas in November of 44, I believe it was. And they were brought up to the front lines in the area known as the Ardennes Forest on the border of Belgium and Germany, and they were put in what was considered to be a quiet sector. The army wanted them to get kind of their feet wet, used to the sounds of battle, but there was no real expectation that the Germans were going to launch an attack right in that sector. The 106th came in, replaced the 28th, which was in that position, and the 28th Division was moved to a spot further north, and in fact, the Americans were getting ready for a winter offensive when the Germans hit, and I think the Germans probably knew that this 106th Division was a green outfit that had never seen combat before, and probably thought that they could plunge through the 106th positions quite easily. When the 106th got to the front line, there was a sense on the part of the officers that they're going into a quiet sector. There wasn't really much expectation of anything happening. They had delayed in setting up their artillery concentrations to their front. They had delayed in making contact with the Allied units to their left and right flanks. So there was I say in the book, a general sense that nobody was going to expect them to do any real soldiering anytime soon.
Hmm.
And so mentally they were unprepared as well as physically for what happened on the night of December 15, 16, 1944, when the Germans pushed tens of thousands of men through their sector, and there was just total panic, and officers were killed, and nobody knew what was happening or what to do, where to go, and the men were basically giving up in droves.
Hmm. And, of course, what ensues is a really horrific experience for all those who are captured.
Right.
First of all, being captured and brought to a POW base in a little community called Bad Orb.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not even really the worst of what they would face, but of course a bad enough experience. And you help us understand how a typical German prisoner of war camp, Kriegsgefangenslager, how that would sort of function.
Right, right. The prisoner of war camps that the Germans had set up, they had dozens and dozens of them all across Germany, and they had a variety of different prisoners in them. This Stalag 9B, which was the one that many of the prisoners captured in the Battle of the Bulge were sent to, already had Russians, British, French, Polish troops that had been captured earlier in there. So the camp was already overcrowded, and by the time the Americans got there, the rations were minimal at best, pretty gross stuff, turnip soup, grass soup, things of that sort. So malnutrition was a major problem. The barracks were unheated. There were few sanitary facilities, no bathrooms really to speak of, no place to shower or wash. So the men lived in filth most of the time. They were all covered with lice. Most of them were ill with dysentery and the various other diseases brought on by the unsanitary conditions. And they were just, really basically as bad off as anyone who was in the concentration camps such as Buchenwald or Dachau.
You mentioned the fact that, first of all, in such a striking sort of irony, that this camp before the war had been a nature camp for children, of all things.
Yeah, and it was kind of like a combination scout camp, nature camp type of facility. And once the war began, it was turned into a prisoner of war camp. It was located on top of a hill in a forest outside of the little town of Bad Orb, about 30 miles east of Frankfurt. And at one point, after the Americans had piled into the camp and stretched its facilities to the maximum, the word came down to the commandant of Stalag 9B to send 350 Americans, including all of the Jewish Americans that they could find in the camp, send those by train to the town of Berga, where there was a slave labor facility that was set up. And so, it was horrible enough that these men were placed in this awful POW camp, but now there were 350 of them were on their way to something that they could not even imagine was going to happen.
You talk about how these men who were Jewish soldiers faced a difficult choice of whether or not to admit that they were Jewish or not.
Yeah.
Some of them had removed their dog tags, you say, because back then it was customary for a soldier's religion to be imprinted on his dog tags in case something happened to him, so the proper sort of burial would be done. But even ahead of the experience of actually stepping aboard that boxcar, these Jewish soldiers faced a very painful moment of decision about whether or not to admit, in effect, that they were Jewish.
Yes, the authorities in the camp ordered all of the Jewish prisoners to step forward at roll call the next day. And that night, prior to the roll call, there were arguments, there were debates going on in the barracks about whether the Jewish soldiers should do that. And some of the Jewish soldiers said, "Yes, I'll do it. I'm proud I'm Jewish, and I'm going to do it." Others said, no way am I going to do it. And there was also among the non-Jewish prisoners pressure one way or the other. Some of them said, you know, you shouldn't do that. You know, we'll tell the Germans that you're, you know, not Jewish. You're Protestant. You're Catholic. Whatever. And others, because they wanted more bread, were blackmailing their Jewish comrades, saying, you know, if you don't give me bread, I'm going to tell the Germans that you're Jewish. And so there was a great deal of heated debate that went on. And the next day, when the soldiers were told that the Jews had to step forward, many of them did, and a few didn't. And so it was a great moral dilemma for the soldiers as to what they should do. There was some fear on the part that if they didn't step forward, then their comrades might be killed as well. So there was a great deal of anguish that went on.
You tell a moving story of one Jewish soldier, Leon Horowitz, who actually succumbs to pneumonia just as this is about to occur, and so he's actually left behind in the prison camp hospital at Bad Orb, and so is able to remain behind and survives, and tells the story actually of in gratitude joining the Protestant choir, which was circulating through the hospital and singing for the patients. What a beautiful moment that is.
Yes, he went to the Protestant chaplain and he said, "Do you think it would be all right with God if I joined the choir?" And the chaplain said, "I think it would be very much all right with God if you did that."
Hmm. At Berge, of course, it is a horrific situation. Many of the men put to work in tunnels. One of them is quoted, I think, so strikingly in saying that this scene of unending, torturous labor in these tunnels was like something out of Dante's Inferno.
Yes, we have this scene where the Americans are working in these tunnels, which were being dug to create a bomb-proof factory, as it were, for the manufacture of synthetic fuels. And there were something like 17, 18 tunnels dug into a slate mountain, and then they were going to be connected by one long chamber. And for 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, the Americans were forced to work in these tunnels without any sort of protective equipment. They're being beaten by their guards if they're not working fast enough. And they're also working alongside about 2,000 slave laborers from the Buchenwald concentration camp, which isn't all that far away from Berge. And you know, they're working night and day in these tunnels. When there are air raids, they put canvas curtains over the tunnel entrances to make sure the light doesn't show and give it away to the bombers up above. And then at the end of their 12-hour shift, they're marched back to their camp where they're, you know, the only thing they have to eat is very thin soup. They're continually brutalized by the guards in the camp, and it just, you know, 24 hours of misery, and they never thought it would end.
You say that escape was all but impossible, and for many of them, the only thing they could really do to lash out at their captors was in sort of a sneaky use of sabotage in this work which they were asked to do. I want to read a very, very striking quote from someone who says, I think this is Norman Fellman, one of the soldiers you talked to. "You could, and this is something that haunts the survivors to this day, you could be talking to someone during the morning, and that guy would die sometime during the day. They would stack his body like firewood right where the chow line was, and you could walk by it and not be moved and not even look at it. It could have been pieces of wood, not human beings. The only thing that mattered was to live another hour." It is difficult to imagine people emerging from such an experience without very, very deep, profound scars. Mm-hmm. For those who were fortunate enough to survive this and the death march, which occurred some days later, how well were they able to survive it, and how?
Well, I think each man had his own private hell to deal with, and it's like any traumatic situation, this one being extended over a period of months. Once it gets in you, it's very hard to to shake it, and I don't believe any of these men were ever fully whole after their experience. They came back to the States, tried to get their lives restarted. Many of them went on to college. Many of them married their sweethearts, tried to put it behind them, built families, built careers, but it never really left them. And some of the men that I talked to said that ever since that day of liberation, they have had nightmares every night. And it's something that they've had to deal with. And because of this so-called secrecy agreement that many of them signed, they had not been able to talk about it with anyone. And I think we know that talking is oftentimes the best therapy. And these men just had to keep their experiences bottled up until just very recently, in the last few years. And but they've all undergone an experience that they could never shake. And as I say in the book, you know, they are still in many ways prisoners of the Nazis. They've never been able to overcome what they went through. And some of them, for some of them, you know, it's still a physical thing that they're hypersensitive to cold weather, for example, or because of the treatment that they had, they still have injuries and wounds that will forever bother them. So psychologically and physically, they're all still dealing with their experience.
As are the citizens of Berge, as you also tell us. And in the book, you open with a chapter that shows us images of the men you talk to as young, raw recruits, and then we are given photos of them at the end of the book in which we see them towards the end of life, those who survived to tell their story to you for this remarkable book called Given Up for Dead, published by Westview Press and the author Flint Whitlock. Flint Whitlock, I congratulate you on a very, very important and beautifully written book, and I thank you for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Greg. Great interview. Super job.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. For the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we probe into one of the most important and influential and intriguing figures in all of world history, and yet someone who most of us actually know very, very little about. And probably most of the assumptions we make about this man are based on myth, superstition, and serious misunderstanding. We are going to be talking today about Napoleon. And the reason for our conversation today is the publication of what promises to be the definitive biography of this important figure, a book called Napoleon, A Life, in which we are exposed to Napoleon, who he was, and how he influenced the world in which he lived, and also the way in which he has been so seriously misunderstood ever since. And Andrew Roberts has done a superb job with this marvelous book, and in a sense, it is no surprise. He is a best-selling author of a number of highly regarded books, including The Storm of War, Masters and Commanders, and others, and has done a great deal of work on various historical documentaries, and for many, many years has been interested in Napoleon, collected much memorabilia related to him, visited many of the battle sites and important archives in Europe where much of the information shared in this new book resides, but has never really been disseminated to the public before. Again, the book is Napoleon, A Life. And Andrew Roberts, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much indeed, Greg. It's a delight to be on.
So, in a sense, this is maybe a pointless question, but I am curious to know why you have been so interested in Napoleon for so long. I mean, not that it's surprising that anyone should be interested in him. There's all kinds of reasons to be interested. But did anything in particular sort of prick your finger the first time and send you on this, what ultimately has been quite a long journey of discovery for you?
Yes. In fact, there was a moment, but it was back in 1973 when my late mother gave me a biography of Napoleon when I was 10 years old. And I read it and loved it, and I've been fascinated by him ever since. In fact, I've gone back to the book. It's not a terribly good book, in fact, but nonetheless, it was enough to spark the interest of a 10-year-old and keep me really fascinated ever since.
You say something in the introduction to the book that I really have to ask you about. In talking about how much Napoleon has been discussed over the generations, even if the result has been a serious misunderstanding of him. At one point you write, more books have been written with the name Napoleon in the title than there have been days since his death in 1821. I'm trying to decide if that can possibly be literally true. I think it is literally true.
Yes, and on top of the many tens of thousands of books written with Napoleon in the title, there have been 3,500 biographies of him. So really, what makes mine different, I believe, is that, well, first of all, it's the first cradle to the grave single volume biography in English to be published since the publication between 2004 and the present day of the 33,000 letters that Napoleon signed during his life. They've been published by the Fondation Napoleon in Paris, a very scholarly institute, and I'm the first historian to be able to write a book on the back of them.
You tell us that among many of these previous books that have been written, that in many cases, if they drew upon correspondence, it was correspondence that had been culled by Napoleon III, and evidently correspondence which was rather seriously mishandled or distorted for the sake of maybe nothing more than simple propaganda. Tell us what has been done in the past, because I think it helps us appreciate then the clarity and truthfulness of what you've done in this new biography.
Yes, some pretty terrible things were done with the correspondence of Napoleon. His, as you mentioned, his nephew, the Emperor Napoleon III, cut out anything that that put Napoleon in a bad light. But it turned out that many of the letters, certainly the sexual letters, he wrote letters of a very erotic nature to his wife Josephine. Those were all the sort of erotic parts were all cut out, and much worse than that, some false letters that Napoleon never read were inserted into the correspondence, which we now can you know expunge and get rid of, and not take into consideration. So it does require this new set of correspondence, which is unbelievably scholarly, beautifully footnoted, and wonderfully presented. Entirely does change our view of the great man.
Hmm. And in your view, he really was a great man. In fact, one of the central points of your book, to which you return again and again, is the fact that so much of what we take for granted in the modern civilized world, particularly some of the ideas by which many nations govern themselves and sort of handle matters of society and culture, can be traced back to Napoleon. And if he didn't create such ideas, he in many cases really helped expand them or make them more of an intricate part of life. Tell us some of those ideas to which we really owe a debt of gratitude to Napoleon.
Yes, well, of course, Americans had, before the French Revolution, had already had their revolution. So you did have your constitution, an extraordinary document of the Enlightenment. But that wasn't the case in Prussia and Austria and Russia and France at the time of the Ancien Régime. So when the French Revolution burst into the world and set up a series of ideals it wasn't able to to keep up to, as the guillotine showed so monstrously fairly soon afterwards. Nonetheless, Napoleon was the person who managed to keep the best ideas of the French Revolution, religious toleration, the abolition of feudalism, equality before the law, these kind of concepts, meritocracy, ideas by which all modern, successful modern civilized nations live by today. And he extended them geographically, he codified them, and he protected them. So that when the Bourbons came back to power after his fall, after the Battle of Waterloo, they were not able to put that France back onto the old Ancien Régime. And so as a result, these ideas took root in Europe and managed to extend themselves.
Hmm. We're speaking with Andrew Roberts about his newest book, which is called Napoleon, A Life. Much of what you write in this book helps us cast away some of the ideas which have been in place for so long. I mean, they're practically calcified. And one of them, of course, is that when most of us think of Napoleon, we think of him as, in your words, the quintessential warmonger. When, in fact, you tell us war was declared on him far more than he was declaring war on others. Help us understand how such a thing can possibly be true, because it feels so wrong or so contrary to what most of us have been told about Napoleon over the years.
Well, that's right. That's right. As you say, it has, that's a good phrase, it has calcified. But the fact is, just because they're called the Napoleonic Wars, it doesn't mean he was responsible for them all. He was responsible for an appallingly opportunistic attack on Spain and Portugal in 1807 and 1808, which went disastrously wrong for him. He was also, of course, responsible for the 1812 campaign against Russia, which broke his army and effectively led to his downfall. But he was not responsible for either of the two wars of the coalitions that started when he was only an artillery lieutenant after the French Revolution. Those were attempts by the Austrians and the Prussians to crush the French Revolution, strangle it in its cradle. He can't be blamed for those. Neither can he be blamed for the subsequent five wars of the coalitions. There were in all seven coalition wars, which were all declared against him rather than him declaring them on anyone else. And he also tried to make peace in each of those five wars. The fact was, though, that he was a great military leader and a great general who knew that in his 60 battles he won. He won 46 of them and drew 7 of them. So he didn't shrink away from an attack when it was made on him. But nonetheless, he cannot be blamed for all of the wars of the Napoleonic Wars.
To what extent was Napoleon revolutionary in his military thinking or in the way that he led troops into battle? Did he operate by the sort of the standard practices of the day, but just do it very well? Or were there ways in which he was really, in a sense, an original thinker or innovator in this respect?
It was a little bit of both. After France's defeat in the Spanish War of the 7 Years' War in 1763, a lot of French thinkers, military thinkers, came up with some great ideas for how armies could be modernized. The best idea being the corps system. So instead of having huge amounts of infantry, cavalry, and artillery all separate, you created mini armies, corps, which had a few infantry, cavalry, and artillery in them, and they were able, therefore, to maneuver separately and to get to battlefields in such a way that they could outmaneuver the enemy and go around the flanks and so on. And Napoleon, although he didn't invent that concept, was the first person to perfect it and to unleash it on an unsuspecting Europe. By 1812, all the other countries in Europe had adopted it, and of course it stayed in the military lexicon until 1945. So he was somebody who didn't originally come up with the idea, but he used it, and he also, through things like speeding up the armies. In the old days, people would stop and besiege cities. He didn't do that. He concentrated on the enemy army, tried to destroy it in the field, and realized that the city would fall afterwards if he had managed to achieve that. So in that sense, he was an innovator as well.
Hmm. You write at one point, Napoleon represented the Enlightenment on horseback. What do you mean by that phrase?
Well, I very much mean the ideas that he took from Rousseau and Voltaire and the other Enlightenment thinkers. These ideas of, as I mentioned earlier, meritocracy and equality before the law, which you didn't see in many of the European states at the time. When he went into, for example, Italy and Germany, one of the first things he would do would be to liberate the Jews. He would let them out of their ghettos. He would stop them wearing the yellow star. He would allow them to have civil and religious liberty, and he would, in places like Malta, for example, stop them from being sold into slavery and allow them to build synagogues for the first time. Now, that is Enlightenment thinking, but it wouldn't have been able to have happened unless he had been on horseback, unless his armies had been successful in the field. So the abolition of the Spanish Inquisition, for example, in Spain, was an integral part of what he was trying to do for Europe.
Hmm. Among the notable events in Napoleon's career was his decision to invade Russia, which you caution us to say was not in and of itself his worst mistake or most foolish mistake. For however disastrous it ultimately turned out to be, there were reasons why he did that. Say a word about this really critical moment in Napoleon's life and career.
Yes. The invasion of Russia in 1812 has been totally misunderstood. It's always been seen by historians as an example of the Napoleon complex. Now, I don't believe Napoleon had a Napoleon complex. I don't believe that one can see hubris leading to nemesis in that classic ancient Greek dramatic trope. In fact, he had perfectly rational, logical reasons to invade Russia. He didn't want to go as far as Moscow. He just wanted to fight a battle on the borders of Moscow, but got sucked further in. But nonetheless, he had an army twice the size of the Russians. He had defeated the Russians twice before. He had no idea that typhus was going to destroy so many of his men. It was a disease that wasn't even diagnosed until 1911, nearly 100 years later. And he had no idea that the Russians were going to have this scorched earth policy by which they actually burnt down two-thirds of their own co-capital, Moscow. So many of these assumptions made about Napoleon, that he almost went mad with power and became a sort of almost a lunatic at the end of his career, are completely wrong. In fact, he had plans to stop earlier at Vitebsk and Smolensk, which of course he should have done. And he also allowed enough time to get from Moscow to Smolensk, even more time than he had taken getting from Smolensk to Moscow. So the idea that he didn't know that Russia had a bad winter is also an absurdity. No, the major problem came when he took a decision, one of many thousands that he took, of course, as a soldier, after the Battle of Maloyaroslavets in October 1812, to go north rather than to go west. And he took that decision. It was turned out to be a disastrous one, and it led to the horrors, the cannibalism, and all the rest of the retreat from Moscow.
Hmm. It's so intriguing, isn't it, that when we think of Napoleon, we immediately think of Waterloo. And of course, we can think of probably a lot of important figures in history whose careers ended with some kind of catastrophic reversal, but it might not be a name that resonates the way the name Waterloo resonates, and it really colors our perception of who he was.
That's right, yes. He most definitely did meet his Waterloo on the 18th of June 1815. And it was a very strange battle, really, in that he broke all of his military maxims, all of the rules by which he had done so well up until then. And only the previous year, in 1814, he had won 4 victories in 5 days. But at Waterloo, it all collapsed. And part of it was, as I say, not just that he was absolutely against one of the greatest, if not the greatest, British general in the Duke of Wellington, but also because he split his army just before the battle, which was a disastrous thing to do. He didn't know where the Prussians were. His intelligence failed him. He started the battle far too late. It was a series of mistakes that that all go against his own military maxims.
Mm. We have to hurry through two last questions, and I regret that because they're two very interesting matters. One of them is Napoleon and Josephine, and one of the most important things your book does is to sort of recast that relationship, which in your view was in no way a Romeo and Juliet relationship.
It really wasn't. She was unfaithful to him within weeks of the marriage. And he found out 2 years later when he was in the desert outside Cairo. And at that point, he embarked on the first of what I've identified as 22 love affairs with various mistresses. So no, it certainly wasn't Romeo and Juliet. However, they did actually for 10 years have a happy happy relationship. They got on well. It's a far more complex, far more human, far more interesting story than the classic Romeo and Juliet one.
You have already mentioned the 33,000 signed letters of Napoleon, which you have utilized in crafting this biography. In what way do these letters let us into kind of the inner chambers of Napoleon's soul and heart? I mean, how personal are these letters?
No, it's a very good question. They're immensely personal, all of them. As I say, he signed all of them. They're to his closest confidants, his friends, his mistresses, his wives, his palace officials, his marshals and generals, of course, and his ministers. And they show the passion of the man, a deeply, deeply passionate individual, a one who could write. He had the most beautiful written style, but also a man who could compartmentalize his life and his mind to such a degree that when he's moving armies across Europe, he's also writing to the prefect of Genoa to tell him to stop taking his mistress to the opera. Or when, just before the Battle of Borodino, he is this huge battle is about to start, he's sitting down the night before and writing the rules and regulations of the Comédie Française back in Paris. This is an astonishing account. I mean, when the Kremlin is almost burnt down in 1812, and he returns to Moscow and goes back into the Kremlin, which has just been saved from being burnt down. He then actually writes the rules of a girls' school at Saint-Denis outside Paris that he wants to build. I mean, this is an extraordinary mind, a capacity for multitasking, which is truly astonishing.
He's an astonishing figure in many ways. At one point you write, Napoleon convinced his followers they were taking part in an adventure, a pageant, an experiment, and a story whose sheer splendor would draw the attention of posterity for centuries. He was able to impart to ordinary people the sense that their lives, and if necessary their deaths in battle, mattered in the context of great events. They too could make history. The book again is called Napoleon, A Life, and the author, Andrew Roberts. Andrew Roberts, congratulations. You must be so justifiably proud of this accomplishment, and I'm so glad we got to talk today on The Morning Show about your marvelous book. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it. Great honor.
Tomorrow on the morning show, it will be the monthly visit of Nan Calvert, and with her will be her good friend and colleague Dave Giordani, who is the executive director of Root Pike Win, the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network. And we'll be talking about a new acquisition and project, which they are very, very busy with right now. That will be tomorrow on the morning show, beginning just